I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello everyone, I am Claire, the events manager at the London Review Bookshop, except I'm not at the shop tonight, obviously. I wish we were all there together, but unfortunately we're doing it this way, but it's a good next best thing. I'm delighted to welcome you all to help celebrate the launch of Speculative Communities. And I'm delighted to welcome the author, Aris Comparozos Athanasiou, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at University College London. Speculative Communities, Living with Uncertainty in a Financialized World, is published by University of Chicago Press. First book, and is currently working on a new book project, tentatively titled Real Fake, An Intellectual History of Distortion and Capitalist Mythmaking. I am delighted to also welcome the rest of our panel. Will Davies is Professor of Political Economy at Goldsmiths, University of London. He's author most recently of This Is Not Normal, The Collapse of Liberal Britain, and is a regular contributor to the London Review of Books. He's also the co-author of the forthcoming Unprecedented, How COVID-19 Revealed the Politics of Our Economy, that's out from MIT Press in March. Grace Blakely is an economic and political commentator, journalist and author. She's a staff writer for Tribune magazine and the author of Stolen, How to Save the World from Financialization and the Corona Crash, How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism. She's currently working on her next book, which will be out in the next year or so, and we're very much looking forward to that. James Bridle is a writer and artist working across technologies and disciplines. Their artworks have been exhibited in galleries worldwide and on the internet. Their writing can be found in Wired, The Atlantic and The New Statesman, amongst others. They're the author of New Dark Age, and Ways of Being, due to be published this coming April. I will, of course, be posting links to all of the books that are available in the chat, and the chat and the Q&A function is also the place where you can post questions for our panel, and I will get them over to them. I think that's about it, really. I'll be posting links to the books, do some questions. I don't need to tell you to knock over your wine glasses because we're not at the shop. I'll hand over to Will. Thank you all very much.
Great. Thanks very much, Claire, for that introduction. And thanks, everybody, for joining us this evening, and particularly to Aris for inviting me and my co-panelists to come along to this event to celebrate the publication of this terrific book, which I enjoyed tremendously. And there's a huge amount of fascinating sociological and economic and cultural material that we have to get our teeth into this evening. The way we thought we'd make this work, I'm not really going to do much chairing, I'm here just simply to kind of kick proceedings off, is that I think we all want to understand more about the thesis of the book, and we're going to start with Aris outlining some of the core claims in the book. Perhaps there'll be some discussion amongst the panelists immediately following that. We'll see how it goes. I'm hoping that this is going to follow a fairly organic approach. There will be, we're going to then take contributions in turn. Firstly, from Grace on some of the issues to do with the speculative economic dimensions of the thesis of the book. For 5 minutes or so, then maybe some responses from Aris, maybe some more discussion. We'll kind of see how it goes. Then James is going to make some similar contributions about a different section of the book, and following a similar format, we'll take a few minutes to hear some of those comments, get some responses. Aris will be able to respond to any particular questions that James has. And then thirdly, I will also make a similar contribution in relation to some of the claims about politics and populism that come towards the end of the book. So hopefully over the course of that, those of you who've joined us will get a pretty good sense of the themes of the book. It's an expansive analysis, but hopefully we'll be able to cover at least some of the central claims and concerns that Aris brings to this. So I really wanted to sort of start things off by trying to get to some of what the core concern of this book is. It seems to me that, Aris, at the heart of this, there's a claim about something that changes around about 2008, around about the time of the global financial crisis, where something is displaced and something perhaps not unprecedented, but something novel in certain respects is born. And one way of framing this is that you talk about the rise of a particular version of individual agency, individual subjectivity that you name following the concept of Homo economicus, which is something that dates back hundreds of years in the history of economics and utilitarianism. You name an alternative form of human agency and human subjectivity that you call homo speculans, which you have your own genealogy of, which places a particular emphasis on the rise of futures markets in Chicago in the 19th century. But you also make a quite a distinctive claim about how this different form of agency comes into being in the wake of the global financial crisis, so relatively recently. Could you just tell us a bit more about that and try to isolate some of these central claims in the book?
Yeah, thank you so much, Will. And before I talk a little bit about this new subjectivity that you described, just let me also thank all three of you for being here today. It's really a great pleasure to have you join this event. I don't think I could have started to launch the event with a better group of people, and also people that hasn't been in conversation previously. So an interesting kind of way of speculative community that we ourselves are formulating right now. As to the points that Will mentioned in the introduction, in terms of this transition, this moment following the financial crisis of 2008, where I locate in the book and in my argument as a very critical moment in this, the emergence, the more visible emergence of a new type of social, economic and political subject, which I call homo speculans. This is, and the godfather of which is a good friend of mine, a classicist who helped me actually formulate, come up with the term itself. The intention behind this new, behind coming up with this term and this label is, starts in fact with a dissatisfaction, somewhat almost frustration, I would say, with the way in which the other label that Will mentioned, Homo economicus, has been used over the course of many, many years, for centuries, but also its persistence, both within the discipline of economics, the way in which economists view actors, rational people as rational agents, maximizing utility with their choices, or when they don't do that, in the more sophisticated version of economics, they focus on bounded rationality and other ways of tracing the limits of rationality. How can we account for the irrational? But there is a persistence of a binary thinking that I think Homo economicus represents in the discipline of economics itself, but also, and I think more alarmingly, there is a persistence on a rather narrow focus on Homo economicus, its rationality and irrationality within politics and to a certain degree, political theory often uses that framing of Homo economicus as to center critiques of the way in which financial capitalism, its recent forms, limits our political subjectivity precisely through exercising an over-rationalizing force over political subjects, a fragmenting force, a force that atomizes society. So with Homo Speculans, what I try to do is shift the conversation away from this unhelpful framing of Homo Economicus, and this is also, and to move us to a conversation about the more relational, the more imaginative ways in which human agents behave in economics, but in society and politics as well. So on the first level, my intention there is to look at the world of finance, look at the world of financialized capitalism and financialization, a work, by the way, that Grace has done brilliantly in her own work in giving us a sense of how the mechanics and the intricacies of finance and how it works, how it suffocates and it penetrates into all realms of our everyday lives. But so I wanted to use that figure of the Homo Speculans, that more imaginative, more relational figure, to dive into some of those intricacies of finance from a different perspective, from the perspective of the imagination. That is the key kind of argument I make in the book, that in order to understand those intricacies, complexities, and flaws of financialized capitalism, we can't simply consider it a force of reason or of irrationality, but we need to see the way in which finance itself imagines our world, and the way in which, in turn, that imagination influences the way we ourselves as human beings, as a society, imagine our sense of community, how we seek to develop bonds and social formations under that influence of the financial imagination. And so, because I don't want to talk too much about this, I'm sure you'll all have greatly, very important things to say on this, but it also, I just want to say very briefly how it also links with the work, how this concept, way of framing, links to the work of also James and Will, and I think both of whose work has been very influential for me. So part of the argument of the book is that this new subject, this new political, economic and social subject, establishes itself through relying on technologies, on new digital technologies, the kind of commodified financialized technologies that we all have access to to different extent. And it is through that through those technologies that a lot of those connections are being pursued. But also what's interesting with these technologies is that, much like finance itself, they are a bit of a dark, a black box. We don't know much about how, we don't always understand, they're very confusing, we don't always understand their mechanics, their internal mechanics, the way in which they feed into our confusing and uncertain moment. And this is something that James has shown brilliantly in his in their own work. And I claim in the book that we need to look at those, how these technologies become nodes for speculative communities around which our communities formulate, take shape, and often in ways that are not immediately understood or discernible. We don't always understand what a speculative community might look like in that sense. And I give many examples in the book of what kind of technologies these can be, and from Instagram and TikTok to dating apps or astrology apps. Technologies, in a nutshell, that relate us, mediate our relationship with the uncertain moment, with a radically uncertain moment, especially post-2008. And so while at the same time mirror that uncertainty, they don't offer us answers. And that links to the political importance of all this analysis, which is the third part of the book. And I think there is some affinity here with Will's thinking and his own work, in that that landscape, that confusing, uncertain landscape where we can no longer tell truth from lie and fact from fiction, and this environment that is exacerbated by the digital technologies and the cloud in which we find ourselves immersed in, is precisely the environment in which our political subjectivity is exercised. It's the environment in which Trump and Modi and Bolsonaro come about and the Brexit vote comes about. And this is a paradox that I locate in the book, in that people seem to be, large swathes of community, of society, seem attracted to the populist ideas that these parties represent. So why is that? Well, even though they don't seem to offer answer to their uncertainty and the volatility that they're exposed to, devastating effects. So why do they do so? And part of the argument is that they do so in a speculative way. They treat uncertainty, the uncertainty that they've been exposed to over years of neoliberal exposure to neoliberal policies of austerity and so on. They place wagers on the uncertainty of the moment by making those political choices. And finally, the book looks at then, is that all there is then? You know, is this politics of sowing uncertainty and confusion to reap power? Is that all there is? And I'm a little bit more optimistic than that. And I try to look at moments where other responses, other kind of political weaponizations of uncertainty can emerge, and indeed do emerge in this kind of chaotic political moment. And I call those counter speculations. And these are very much linked with not only the aspect of speculation which relates to uncertainty, which relates to taking looking at uncertainty in the eye, to taking upfront risks, but also to the other aspect of speculation, which is insurance. A speculator is also someone who takes on unwanted risk by others, by prevents markets of overheating, as they say. So there is an insurance element, that a security element that speculation can offer. And so my claim is that nationalism can be one such symbolic insurance, but the task of a progressive counter speculation, I claim in the book, is one of coming up with more resilient, progressive forms of collective insurance, of collective, of collectivizations of uncertainty that can allow for those upfront engagements with uncertainty to give more progressive and democratic outcomes.
Great, thank you very much, Aris, for that. Overview of the overall thesis of the book. I'm relying on all panelists to wave or raise a hand if anyone wants to respond immediately, because we don't have to stick rigidly to any particular format in any of this. But there's quite a lot there for us to chew on already. And I think you've touched on some of the issues that are going to come up in some of the responses that follow. But unless Grace or James immediately wants to pick up on that, and I don't think I have any particular comments I want to make at this stage, I'd now like to invite Grace to discuss some of the specifically financial claims in the book, because the book begins with a section on speculation in the more conventional sense of finance and capitalism. So, Grace, over to you.
Thanks, Will, and thanks, Aris. So I want to talk a little bit today about what my first thoughts were when I was initially given the title to this book and read a little bit about this idea of homo speculans, because the first thing I thought was my mind, you know, went to something like GameStop or cryptocurrency, these kind of groups of people predominantly online who are engaging in a form of speculation and really forming quite kind of deep and solidaristic communities. And it brought me back to, and reading the book brought me back to this as well, to an article I wrote around the time of the GameStop saga, calling it the revenge of the mini capitalists. And this links back to a well-known argument about the kind of role of neoliberalism in forming a particular kind of subjectivity linked to these processes of financialization, which is highly functional for these processes of financialization, whereby the individual as part of a household comes to conceive of many aspects of their lives and indeed their very self through this kind of balance sheet mentality as a set of assets and liabilities, whether we're talking about, you know, the value of one's home relative to the value of one's outstanding debt, or indeed the value of one's human capital relative to the outstanding debt you might have taken on to take out a mortgage. So the idea when this GameStop saga happened, which, by the way, for those who aren't familiar, was basically a community on Reddit decided that they were going to undertake a short squeeze against a bunch of hedge funds that were short selling this stock in a particular company. And for a while, it looked as though they might succeed. In the end, the institutions of financial capital, many of which are aligned to the state, ended up subverting that project. But it was a kind of very powerful movement while it lasted. And it kind of, I feel like, drew on a lot of the anti-systemic and anti-capitalist, ironically, narratives that were and remain relatively popular today in those particular sections of the internet. And I kind of wrote this piece being like, well, actually, lots of people buying shares, and bear in mind, these are predominantly well-off people, particularly if we look at this in the context of the world economy, lots of people buying shares to screw over a hedge fund is not necessarily the kind of, you know, radical utopian project that lots of people think it is. In many ways, it is the kind of apogee of the kind of project that, you know, Thatcher, Reagan and others were attempting to push, which was, don't conceive of your interests, don't conceive of your potential to resist capitalism as part of an organized group of workers, conceive of it as, you know, a part owner of a company who is able to use their voice as a shareholder, or perhaps, you know, as a voter who is able to use their voice as a consumer of public services or whatever. This kind of very individualistic and, as you were saying, Aris, quite atomized view of human agency. But reading your book, Aris, I was kind of pushed a little bit to think less about the way in which this kind of neoliberal subjectivity leads to this process of atomization, and more about the ways in which it can foster a sense of community. And that is why my thoughts were initially drawn to, yes, GameStop, but also the massive and very interesting communities that I think have emerged, particularly over the last kind of 5 or 10 years, in and around cryptocurrency. Now, I am not an advocate of this particular form of speculation, or but I don't think that's really relevant to the discussion that we're having today. It's interesting that these communities have formed and have begun to have quite a significant impact, particularly in kind of small corners of the crypto world, in the same way that GameStop was able to have quite a significant impact as well. And it made me think again about a piece that came out in the FT about a year ago now, where basically a few writers, I think it was Gillian Tett and Robin Wrigglesworth, were writing about how crypto is a cult. And my first thought when I read that was, well, yes, it's completely rational for crypto to behave as like it's a cult, because, you know, there's no real objective measure of the value of these assets, as you might have, say, with a share, where you could, you know, say it was the net present value of future dividends payments or profits or whatever. You know, when you have these entities that are basically just entirely based on expectations, then it makes sense for people within these communities to kind of hype these things up and talk down outsiders. But actually, reading your book, Aris, it made me think a little bit more about the kind of sociology of these communities and how they do represent, you know, engagement with these communities represents a particular kind of what you might say, what you might call insurance, or at the very least, kind of game playing in the context of uncertainty, in the context of uncertainty that has become much more pervasive since the financial crisis. And in the context of a financialized capitalism that seems much more chaotic, where the kind of balance sheet mentality that you might have had pre-financial crisis, which is, you know, over the course of my life, I will build up assets and then we'll draw down from those assets, through to a more kind of Wild West speculative post-crisis world, where it really is kind of, you know, you have got to engage with these activities, engage with these behaviors in the best way that you can, simply just to be able to survive, whether you're thinking about, you know, someone who's working in the gig economy or someone who's speculating on cryptocurrency. And it is interesting looking into these, because I've kind of had a little bit more experience of seeing what goes on in these worlds. And there really is a sense of deep solidarity and community amongst these people. And you can see it in certain groups where there's kind of a large number of people who hold a lot of coins or tokens talking with one another in often quite kind of did I just get lost for a second there?
Where are you still, Grace? Oh, there you are. Okay.
Am I back now? I don't know what happened there. It just cut out.
You're back.
Cool. Good. But yeah, talking to each other about what they should do and coordinating their moves around these tokens to kind of stabilize the price, or to, you know, think about what's going to happen to the rest of the community. And I think that was, you know, very interesting to observe. I'm obviously not saying again that I'm kind of endorsing or these behaviors or converted to crypto or any of these things, but it is interesting to note that this isn't just an individuating process. It's also a process that is building genuine kind of ties and solidarities. The one thing that I really want to point out, and we talked a little bit about this on the podcast, Aris, is just quite how staggeringly unequal participation in these communities is and how hierarchical they are. Particularly if you look at, say, cryptocurrency, you know, you have a relatively small number of people who have a huge amount of power. This is even more the case when you come to NFTs, for example, where there's, I think it's 32 wallets with 32 million. It's something like there's 320 wallets or something with $1 million worth of NFTs in them each. That is the wrong statistic, actually, but it's very unequal. I'll need to look it up. And it's, you know, the same, of course, when you look across many of these different markets, very, very unequal, very hierarchical, a small number of people who've basically been able to use pre-existing wealth, power, social capital to insure themselves against risk, but also become very, very wealthy. And I think, Aris, this also applies, interestingly enough, in some of the other communities that you analyze in the book, in dating, for example, where you see on these dating apps, you know, you get reports or news articles about the most popular dating profiles, where there's like 10 people who get tons and tons of likes and everyone else is kind of excluded. And I think that inequality is a really interesting point because it feeds into the discussion at the end of the book around populism. Because the losers of these speculative games and the losers, the people who kind of get the mark of losers within these communities, are the ones often that are driving this populist resurgence. And the thing that made me think about was Bannon, who obviously had these failed stock market bets, which is what turned him against capitalism in general. I said, oh, I want to kind of screw around with the system and basically kind of like screw the stock market, screw these guys, I want to drain the swamp, and became this really insider, outsider, anti-systemic, but within the system figure. And also, you know, you see it in the world of dating, the kind of losers are the incels who are driving this real backlash against this, what they see as a I cut out again there. I was gonna stop now anyway, because I was just about to wrap up. I guess the thing that stood out to me most in that discussion was, yes, this kind of tension between individuation and community, which I think in the book you highlight really well as mediated by this idea of the speculative imagination, but also the real need to focus on these inequalities that exist within these communities and the political implications of those.
Thanks, Grace. Aris, do you want to come back on any of that?
Perhaps very briefly, because I'm keen on hearing from James and yourself, Will. Just to say, I mean, I think these are really excellent points and a very very close and deep reading of my argument. And I think your examples of the crypto communities are very important. And actually, when I was writing the book, crypto communities, crypto trading was a big thing, but it hadn't exploded in the way that it has in the mainstream kind of coverage over the last year or a couple of years or so. Just to add that when we use words like cult and the way in which the NFT communities, crypto communities are sort of dismissed as almost, you know, conspiratorial and cult. I mean, there is something there that is lost in looking at the kind of myth building aspect of those communities, which is it's very imaginative and it speaks directly to the need for narrative, the need for community, and so it does a very important job that simply cannot be answered by the question of interests or immediate kind of profit and benefit from that it's often sort of framed as a paradox, as I was talking about earlier, and that yes, revenge is a part of it. I think it's an important aspect of it, but I think what I was trying to do in the book is emphasize that even when what is on first level most obvious is this kind of power of this vengeful politics, that is expressed through some of those right-wing populist communities, there is still underpinning this, is a crave for connection. And it's a connection that is actually fulfilled in more subtle ways. I suppose that's the kind of work that I was interested in doing with the book. But as you said, Grace, I mean, the question of power is so central. And I don't, in fact, I agree with you. I don't see hope in the rise of crypto communities and DAOs and all this decentralization narrative. I don't believe in it. That's the space where the big radical progressive answers will come from that we so desperately need. In fact, in the book, I try to locate some of those answers, those hopeful answers from spaces that are outside of the, strictly speaking, trading kind of communities. So in other words, I try to look at, and I'm sure we'll come to this now, how the speculative imagination is exercised in other realms of our life, and it can actually be very generative politically.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Thanks, Aris. I want to turn now to James to offer some comments, as outlined at the beginning, perhaps particularly on the second section of the book, which is on the question of spectacle. James, over to you.
Thanks very much, Will, and thanks, Aris, again for inviting me, and thanks for everyone. I was going to start by talking about this image or place or something that's been going around my head ever since I read Aris's book. One of the kind of central places that Aris locates the history of speculation in his book is in the Chicago Board of Trade, which was established in the kind of late 19th century, and the place where the futures contract was invented, where derivatives were invented, as I understand it. I'm not a financial historian, and my knowledge of finance is scant, but this is certainly the story Aris tells of the birth of this belief that one could trade on anything, that not only the future was something that could be tradable, that the uncertainty of the future could be traded upon. Today, we don't only have trading on futures, we have trading on the potential volatility of those futures. You can trade on the uncertainty of uncertainty itself. In the book, Aris tells a little of the backstory of the Chicago Board of Trade. And I was thinking about the fact that a few years ago, I visited Chicago, and I went to the Chicago Art Institute. And in the basement of the Chicago Art Institute, they have I'm not sure it's the original trading floor, but certainly the trading floor from the 1890s of the Chicago Stock Exchange. When that particular building was demolished, they rebuilt it in the basement of the Chicago Institute of Art. And it's this weird, like, ghost-haunted structure. This is the place where, like, this imagining of the speculation of the future was kind of born and given birth to, and it's empty and in the basement of an art museum, which is an image I've been trying to understand ever since I kind of encountered it. And I think Aris's book gave me some of the tools for understanding that, particularly because very successfully in the book, he aligns it with the similar virtualization that's happened to pretty much everything else in the last century. His other kind of great thread in the book is, of course, Benedict Anderson's book, Imagine Communities. And so this, one of the central theses of Anderson's work was that these communities were imagined. They were imagined into being collectively by a shared encounter with and experience of, particularly of media, particularly of newspapers and subsequently of radio and subsequently television, but newspapers figure very large in his account. And they were the tools by which disparate geographical collections of people with very little in common, recent immigrants, particularly in the case of the US and spread across the huge area, were imagined themselves into a kind of shared community. And that's a very powerful way of understanding how we've come out the other side of that completely fractured. Because of course that shared community of media has completely disappeared. It has become entirely virtualized, and therefore it's become something not individualized, because as I think we're all aware, it's something that's deeply shared in community form, but varies completely across every other possible division between people. Something deeply strange has happened when we are all consuming radically different media, even though we may be stood next to each other on the bus or living next door to one another. And that is immediately, you can see how these imagined communities fracture and kind of reform. And so understanding how that for me, one of the things I'm always interested in is the way in which that confusion sown by this kind of radical fragmentation of everyone's everyday experiences, how people react to that. And my framing for that tends to come around questions of agency. And reading Aris's book, I really understood how trading and speculation and these kind of financialized forms were a response to exactly the same thing in miniature that the kind of whole of society is going on. So Aris says this is, we all become like kind of speculators, but I kind of really feel like speculators just were encountering the same problems of uncertainty as the rest of us, just within the particular field that they worked in, which is that they had to operate under these conditions of ever increasing amounts of information, most of which is contradictory, from which it is completely impossible, meaningless, in fact, to try and construct any kind of actual construction of the future. And so the uncertainty is kind of imposed on you. And so how do you construct a narrative out of that? Well, you have to extend that narrative into the future. You have to speculate. It's the only way to kind of take back some, I was going to use the phrase take back control and try to avoid it, but there it is, to establish one's own agency in the lack of any kind of coherent narrative that you can pitch yourself to. I was particularly struck this week. There was a poll done in Greece, where I live, of anti-vaxxers, in which it turned out that 70% of anti-vaxxers, people who refuse the vaccination for COVID, 70% of them said they wouldn't take the vaccination because someone else was telling them to do it. Only 40% actually had like scientific problems or raised medical objections to the vaccine. 70% were just straight up, because I don't want to do what I'm told. And it struck me that this is I think this is universal. I don't think this is just in Greece. I think it's a nice telling of something that's happening all over. That this lack of agency leads people to choose, in this case, kind of conspiracy theory, but also essentially to choose uncertainty. Because the alternative to trust in medical science would be an increase in certainty, but it would have a corresponding loss in agency. And so this desire for narrative, whether it's the narrative of conspiracy theory, or whether it's narrative of populist nationalisms that Aris talks about in the book, or whether it's the uncertainty of kind of financial speculation, it asserts a narrative. It is a story that one can tell about the world that kind of brings back one's place in it. And the only thing that, and this is a contradiction that I haven't quite resolved yet, and maybe Aris can help with, is how to have that kind of agency without resorting either to conspiracy or to these kind of exploitative forms of financial speculation. The answer, of course, is you need actual power, like actual agency, not the illusion of agency, which for me, and I suspect most of us, are rooted in kind of community politics, society. But as I think has been clearly shown, they're not aligned with rationality in any way that makes sense according to traditional economic models. So the economic model doesn't fit, and the political model doesn't really fit. But this, I also feel that this frame of rationality and irrationality is difficult, because even the attempts at conspiracy theory and speculation are also not really to do with irrationality. They're an attempt to behave meaningfully and with agency under conditions of overwhelming uncertainty. I'm trying to end something productive. I was particularly struck by Aris, like me and others, cites Shoshana Zuboff, her surveillance capitalism in the book, with regards to the particularly the kind of the uncertainty that's caused by social media and new technology. And I'm a huge fan of Zuboff's work, in the extent to which it analyzes both the way in which technology companies operate and the ways in which they have found new fields from which to profit. Where we differ remarkably is that I don't think that's some kind of aberration of capitalism. It just seems like more capitalism to me. That there's definitely, you know, just as the speculators followed the uncertainty of everyone, so Silicon Valley is just following capitalism and its ability to discover new fields worth mining to the next logical extent. Grace has already described some of the ways in which these speculative communities emerge around kind of financial speculation. But I guess what I'm really interested in is, what are the examples of speculative communities that break free of the financialized model? Because even the ones that have already been, there's obvious ones like GameStop and crypto and NFTs, which are based in financialization. There's then the ones like dating apps and astrology, but as Grace has said, already feel like they're full of winners and losers and so on and so forth. So is there a way, Aris, in which speculation breaks from that? What are the communities that might be possible through speculation that aren't so rigorously tied to finance and all its destruction?
I'm muted. I'm muted. Thanks, James. Aris, do you want to respond to any of that?
Yeah,
maybe relatively briefly. I'm just keeping a vague eye on the time, which is falls to me to be the...
No, absolutely. And again, I think thank you, James, for this really rich thoughts on the book. And in many ways, you know, you've described very beautifully, and I think even I'd say a little bit more clearly some of the points that I tried to make in the book itself about this kind of this moment and what I tried to do with describing the kind of historical background of this moment of confusion and uncertainty and our responses to it. Just very briefly, I guess, I might be very brief because I think your question does link to the final kind of section of the book and to which Will will speak, which is the political implications of this kind of homo speculans and speculative communities. So the only thing I would say, other than that, I do share very much your skepticism about the side of Zuboff's argument that surveillance capitalism, you know, isn't just a problem to be fixed in capitalism. It's just how, you know, it's endemic. But there is, I suppose, what I wanted to say is that the answers, I don't believe, I'm not offering answers in the book in the sense of, you know, pointing to where, you know, which kind of counter speculation will be more effective in overturning capitalism. But I do nonetheless, and I think I agree there with the point that you make in your book, The New Dark Age, James, that we cannot consider of points of resistance that are entirely outside of those technologies that we inhabit, this kind of complexified, technologized reality that we experience in our everyday life through the apps and through all these instruments. I don't think that one can begin the task of critique and resistance and action entirely removed from those worlds. So part of what I tried to do in the book was to try and offer maybe a language for describing modes of connection and action that are already there, and then point our attention towards them. But yes, but perhaps I'll stop here and I'll let Will share his thoughts.
Yeah, thank you. And yes, I was going to offer some comments on the final section of the book, which is where it becomes more explicitly political. And James's comment, I was actually going to raise some of the same kind of conclusions, actually, that James just did about the question of kind of alternative forms of politics, genuinely alternative, rather than forms of politics that get kind of subsumed by the same kind of financial logic. There's a couple of questions from the chat that I might actually just bring in some of my comments as well, because I think they speak quite nicely to this, and that might help us sort of segue into the chat. I mean, one of the things that the book raises is that there was a kind of argument that went on amongst scholars of neoliberalism and political economists since the financial crisis as to whether populism and nationalism represented a kind of pushback against neoliberalism and a kind of re-embedding or a demand for a re-embedding of the economy in society. So you have these sort of Polanyian scholars. You refer to Polanyi's work in the book. Someone like Wolfgang Strake, people who are familiar with his work, would argue that, you know, a return to the nation, you know, in hopefully a sort of non-toxic sense, if such a thing is possible, might actually be a kind of way of pushing back against the logic of finance and of global capital, and in particular the European Commission for Strake and so on. And then more recently, there's been a set of scholars that have sort of argued, actually, on the contrary, that if you look closely at some of these nationalist and populist projects, they actually align themselves to finance in certain ways, and that they, that in some sense, the pursuit of the nation and of sort of national solidarity and so on, in some ways, is a kind of a works in tandem with certain aspects of neoliberalism. And Aris, you're clearly in the latter camp, you know, along with other scholars who you mentioned, like Michel Fayer. And others, in arguing that populism, which on the face of it, if you listen to Steve Bannon and people, it sounds like it's all about sort of fraternity and tradition and community and so on. But actually, if you examine it more closely and you look at its technologies and its rationalities of rhetoric and of network building and so on, it's actually also another type of speculative project. And that actually it is a different way of projecting an imagined future in ways that is not clearly obviously the same as the way in which financial markets work, but there is a kind of a common logic between the two. And then in the final chapter of the book, you talk about sort of disruptive, kind of alternative, heterodox speculations, forms of kind of almost like a sort of forms of motivated by a logic of kind of meme warfare or of the hacking of political institutions, of these sort of kind of bottom up forms of speculative community. You talk about things like the Gilets Jaunes in France and these sorts of political projects. But I guess that this leads, and I, you know, I'm very, very persuaded by lots of that. I'm persuaded by these analyses that point to some of the kind of the points of commonality between neoliberalism and populism. And I think that, you know, many initial responses to Brexit, which you also discuss, were rather duped by aspects of its sort of, you know, communitarian sort of appeal, and that clearly there were aspects of it that were a sort of more radicalization of certain kind of financial and disruptive logics. But, and this is where I think, you know, I shared James's final question. One of the things that I was left with at the end of this is, how do we think of politics as anything other than speculation by the time we got to the end of the book? And I wanted to sort of, you know, there was a question in the chat from Kate Hines saying, do you think that we all speculate in the face of uncertainty, or do most people seek security? There is the populist turn, a return to a golden past. Well, I mean, I don't want to speak for you, Aris, but I think it's clear that certainly in the logic of the chapter on populism, that you see it not as a kind of straightforwardly sort of sincere return to security, and that actually it is in some ways a different logic of insecurity, maybe a sort of solidaristic logic of insecurity, if that's not a paradox. The other question in the chat, and you know, you can reply to them because they're just as sort of valid questions as the ones that I'm raising, by Rob McMillan, where he says, how do Aris and colleagues, so I guess that's us as well, respond to the possible critique that they present an over-financialized or over-speculative concept of agency? Most people, most of the time, might not pursue such subjectivity. Hence, political projects, interventions are mistaken as actual social and economic trends. And I think that what this, one of the things that the book raised for me as well, despite the fact that I'm actually sympathetic to your, you know, this idea that the logic of speculation goes in all sorts of different directions and underpins all sorts of political projects. But if you were to take some of the, I guess you could say the biggest crisis of the 21st century, which is climate change, it does not obey a logic of uncertainty or speculation. It obeys a logic of crushing certainty and of crushing predictability. And that, I mean, if anything, it's things might be moving faster than some models predict, but that in many ways, the predictability of the future and the predictability of where the costs are going to fall, on which communities they're going to fall and what particular territories they're going to fall, and the predictability of who escapes, and the predictability in relation to, say, COVID or all sorts of other crises at the moment of who benefits and who loses is actually really pretty straightforward a lot of the time. That in many ways, lots of people do not feel themselves to be living lives of uncertainty or of engaged in speculative projects. Actually, the people who died from COVID, you probably could have, you know, it was not surprising what kinds of jobs they did, what particular kinds of communities they came from, and this sort of thing. So there is, in some ways, a kind of, I mean, I'm not to say that we should take populism at face value and that populism is a sort of, you know, in the way that, say, Strake might be very forgiving of aspects of economic nationalism, that it is a sort of, you know, a straightforward demand to restore security and restore certainty. But putting that to one side, there is clearly an aspect to contemporary political economy and contemporary politics, of which I would say something like climate is the sort of most epic example, that costs and benefits get distributed in ways that can be predicted and does not obey perhaps some of this logic. So, and perhaps it poses political questions that cannot simply be met with these kind of speculative answers. So what, and this is in some ways back to James's question, what does non-speculative politics look like today if we're not simply to allow this concept of kind of speculation and of speculative communities and homo speculans to become a kind of all engulfing, as if we are all engaged in these sorts of projects? Because I think that was also a, you know, that was a limit of some neoliberalism theory, which was that, oh, we're all constantly acting as entrepreneurs the entire time. And of course, most people are not acting as entrepreneurs the whole time, and their lives obey a sort of crushing predictability much of the time. And maybe this also links back a little bit to some of what Grace was saying about the inequality within some of these communities, which mean that the winners and the losers are not quite as sort of uncertain as might sometimes be predicted. Sorry, I'm not sure how much, if that all ended up with a particular sort of direct question, but I think that there is a sort of a theme lurking in some of these comments, including from Rob McMillan and Kate Hines's questions in the chat, which is the sort of limits of a speculative logic and what lies outside of it.
Yeah, no, I mean, these are, I think, some really excellent points. And these are the questions that I think are the important ones to ask, really, on reading the book. They are inevitable ones to ask, in fact. What I would say to it, I mean, the first part is something that I always think about, and I think it's something that triggers people's curiosity and kind of skepticism, the way in which I emphasize openness and the embrace of uncertainty, the endorsement of uncertainty, and how that seems quite jarring to people when we live in a world where, you know, nationalism and kind of the right wing kind of culture wars are geared towards a narrative is seemingly a narrative of security. And so, you know, why speculation in that sense? You know, why is it a more accurate kind of framing of the moment? And I suppose for me, I mean, there is something about this coexistence of openness and closure that is really central to how capitalism works and how financial speculation sort of unfolds. And these two dimensions of speculation and insurance that do go hand in hand. And I guess my argument in the book is that we just simply cannot afford to focus on one over the other. We do need both. And linked to that is the argument that forms of stability and security and the collectivization of our uncertain condition, I mean, traditional forms of that we have through literally social security and the welfare state and the NHS and the access to the collective resources, material resources that allow us to live decent lives. But often this kind of security does come with a certain closure in the way we consider the opportunities that openness of the future can bring. And I guess part of what I saw as what I was trying to do in the book is emphasize that in the current moment when everything seems to have unraveled in the way that it has unraveled, the kind of progressive engagement with this moment cannot afford to lose sight of the openness. When it did so, my reading of the events of Brexit and the Trump election and so on was that this is precisely where the left that was articulated there as a response was weak, in that it didn't respond to the need for a future orientation. And to link to the climate question, I mean, it's a huge question. But I think what interests me here is that you're right. I mean, predictive models do give us a very, very undeniably, catastrophic, an accurately catastrophic image of what the future holds in terms of the climate disaster. And so what does speculation have to do with this? I suppose, but I do think that what speculation has to do with it is that a lot of, again, the responses that we get, social collective responses to these climate crises there's a lack of consensus, right? There seems to be a lack of grassroots consensus on that accurately predicted reality. And why is that? At the same time, there are other narratives that circulate. And I guess the claim that I make in the book is that it's not these kind of other narratives, the speculative narratives of the populists and of conspiracy theorists and NFTs and that sort of thing. They're not really what they have in common is that they don't necessarily, unlike what we often think, they don't offer certainty. They're not simple narratives. They're also quite complex narratives. They are underpinned by quite complex kind of elements of myths and all this QAnon stuff is not exactly the simplest narrative that one can come up with. I mean, there are nuances of that of course are very destructive, but they do retain a speculative element, and it is, I think, a response that that people we do see in society a lot. Now, of course, it's not. How do we come out of this? I mean, this is the perennial question here that I haven't directly answered. But I suppose the final thing I want to say is that if there is anything, there's nothing sort of programmatic about the work. I'm not offering a blueprint, but I do. If there was to be a translation, a kind of insight for practicable political implications. For the left and broadly speaking, that would be that weaponizing a speculative logic or a speculative imagination does point us to spaces and to alliances that might not look on first level to make sense. They don't look as though they are the traditional way of occupying a political position across. And I'm thinking, we see the antique lockdown demonstrations, the very disparate elements that consist of this very weird mix of new age yoga mentality and populists and climate deniers and all of that kind of coming together. Pro neoliberal rationalists are part of that too. It's a weird mix. And so part of what I'm saying here is that there is no, the response needs to take account of that. The speculative elements that underpins these strange alliances. So our alliances, the progressive alliances, need to retain some of that element, perhaps, and cultivate it. So yes, this is not maybe a full answer, but maybe a hint of where I'm thinking around this.
Thanks, Aris. No, that's very helpful. And can I just remind the audience members that you are welcome to add your questions to the event chat, and we have a few more minutes left, so there's still time to take more. There's a question's just come in saying, could Aris and all the others say more about the idea of counter speculation? Does this suggest that progressive, radical, subversive, speculative communities too? Well, I think you kind of just answered that in the last your last comment, that I think you certainly do believe that radical, progressive, subversive, speculative communities are possible. And indeed, the final chapter of the book before the conclusion is about precisely that. Is there anything more you want to say about that, Aris, in terms of like how you might define counter-speculation, or how we might distinguish it from other forms of speculative communities in terms of that particular question?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think, I spoke to it just now, but maybe the only thing to add here is that the main, what I call speculative politics is, in the book, I describe as a dominant form of a kind of politics whereby all actors seek to not control or limit volatility, but kind of cultivate it further for the benefit. And so then a counter-speculation emerges from the same space. In other words, it doesn't aim to kind of offer a solution of stability or stability alone, but it aims to weaponize that volatility with a different aim. And the aim there is to challenge the kind of holders of power, of institutional power, of market power, and so on. And the other element is that I see counter-speculations as relying on more equitable and inclusive forms of kind of social insurance and security that allows them to take on those wages. So this is the kind of conceptual distinction that I make. But just maybe very, very quickly in terms of, because in the final chapter, I do bring examples of different forms of counter speculations, and they are quite different. And just to mention, because for those that won't have read it yet, you already spoke about a couple of them, Will, but I talk about things like the digital alliance of subculture groups like fandom communities of TikTok, the Korean pop music kind of fans, and how in their internal communications and through Instagram and TikTok allied with the Black Lives Matter during the wave of protests in the last couple of years. And they did things like sabotage political events of the alt-right and Trump. And they did that, they did create a kind of counter-speculative community there. They did have an impact, a material impact on the sort of enemy, if you like. But I also, at the same time, so that's one form, but I'm not suggesting in the book that the only space to look at for counter-speculations is the virtual kind of digital, even though that's the more perhaps, it's particularly spectacular there, but I talk about things like that our mind wouldn't go to, perhaps like the events that led to the referendum vote in Greece in 2015 around the rejection of the austerity terms that were proposed following the debt crisis. So I'm interested in how voting behavior, a sort of rational kind of voting, seemed to be taking place in a very different arena to clearly a distinction between what's in favor of one's interest and what isn't. The terms of the debate were very occluded about what no or yes would mean in practice. And the only certainty there was that a no vote seemed to mean chaos, an exit from the Eurozone, but it was nonetheless, there was an element of grassroots support for that. And that, unlike Brexit, had much more progressive connotations on the grassroots. So it's an interesting just juxtaposition of the Brexit kind of populist and endorsement of uncertainty and the Greek kind of vote that happened just around the same time as well. But these are very different forms of where counter-speculative imagination can manifest itself. So they don't look the same, but I think they point us to possibilities that are interesting. That are very interesting.
Thanks, Aris.
Just very briefly, because I think the point about climate was really interesting. because the point about climate is that is a very predictable and obvious risk, but it is still characterized by very, very pervasive uncertainty. And I think that's a really important distinction, because there is this whole idea of the risk society. You know, we are, our lives are characterized by these pervasive and sometimes all consuming, like climate change, risks, and we know they're coming. What we don't know is necessarily who is going to be affected by them and how. It's like the difference between knowing that if you lend to an industry in a particular sector, 1% of those businesses will fail, and knowing whether or not the business to which you lend will fail. And of course, the difference between risk and uncertainty, as aside from the kind of possibilities of measurement, is that the whole point about uncertainty, why it's so imbricated with the logic of finance, is that people can always profit from that uncertainty. You can always profit from not knowing who is going to be the one that ends up paying for things like climate breakdown, which is why it's been this profitable avenue for exploitation by the far right. They can kind of cultivate this idea that actually, yes, this thing is happening, but we don't know who it's going to affect. So give me your trust and I will protect you, or we can protect one another. And I think there's, you know, that I suppose within that context of uncertainty, the thing that still exists in a way that it doesn't with risk is this question around agency. I think, James, what you were saying about this lack of control leading people to, and lack of agency leading people to kind of have these different reactions to uncertainty, that's potentially an interesting path for the left, is thinking, right, how do we respond to this sense of a lack of agency, this sense of uncertainty, in a way that isn't just give me your trust, I will protect you, but which is actually how do we empower these communities and give people the chance to build their own collective responses to this pervasive sense of uncertainty?
Thanks, Grace. That's really helpful. James is putting his hand up. We're now getting a discussion just as we've gone past the hour. But yeah, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, I wanted to very briefly, first of all, I wanted to slightly push back against the thing that came up a bit earlier about whether most people live in uncertainty, or I think Will was saying it about, you know, most people's lives actually take the form that might be expected, which is not untrue, but I don't think it takes into account the media imaginary or the social imaginary, which Benedict Anderson outlined and that Harris kind of continues. I was thinking about this kind of century-long emergence of speculation, like, which is originally essentially an occult act. It moves into the mainstream as kind of financial derivative trading, and latterly, as Aris shows in the book, really kind of mainstreams fully as this kind of algorithmic uncertainty, which really does affect everyone, and whether that's in terms of the app-driven kind of gig economy or your kind of tailored news feed or the kind of politics of muddying the water that's kind of equalized across the world, really. It's that the stability of one's actual reality, like the actuarial outcomes of one life when kind of presented on a graph, have very little relation to one's experience of that life, one's expectations for it, and therefore one's experience of uncertainty. So I do think these questions, whether people consciously realize it or not, really do kind of go very deep. And that's why I think there's kind of huge value to this. I also just want to briefly add that one thing that we haven't discussed, even though this is a thing about imagination, is histories of speculative fiction and histories of speculative design, and the fact that there are actually vast speculative imaginaries that exist outside the realm of financialization that are intentionally created not merely to participate in speculation for its own sake, but to design, delineate, like write out, describe other possible worlds with the intention of bringing them into being, which is perhaps something that's a little, you know, almost financialized in the sense of like there's a profit and there's winners and losers. Who gets to define that world? But like if there is a game to be played on the left elsewhere of like who gets to write that world, then there are some tools that work and that have worked and continue to work in fiction and the arts that I think should be part of any kind of discussion of speculative imagination.
Thank you. Aris, you want to very quickly do you have any more comments, or otherwise we'll wrap things up?
No, I think, you know, this is probably, we're already over time, aren't we? And these have been such really brilliant comments and thoughts. And I'm really thankful for this deep engagement that all three of you had with the book. And I think The only thing I would add is that the question of speculative communities and its relevance. I think to the moment, I would say that my hope is that there will be some more engagement with these kind of questions, and maybe asking some of these questions differently and using sort of prompting folks to use some of this vocabulary I'm hoping that it might open up some of the debates around the pressure to produce kind of convincing alternatives as kind of the progressive, the left, however we want to call it, that sometimes seems to be weighing too heavy on our shoulders. And I think part of what I tried to do in the book is to work with openings that might look confusing or ambivalent, but they're nonetheless very important for the conversation. And so, I think that's, I will probably leave it here. And thank you so much again, all three of you. And I know for some of you from other time zones, which is quite late at the moment. So yeah, doubly thanks for your involvement and your engagement.
Great. Thanks very much, Aris. Thanks everybody for joining us this evening. It's a terrific book. I recommend everybody buys a copy. I think there's going to be a link in the chat and also to other work by us panelists. Thanks very much to the LRB and to Claire, LRB Bookshop, and to Claire for organising the event this evening. And thanks everybody for your questions and for joining us.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.